little further. So after, at page 315, saying that aesthetic ideas force puts reason in motion and makes reason think more, Kant goes on to the thought of aesthetic attributes. And he says, if forms do not constitute the exhibition of a given concept itself, but are only supplementary presentations of the imagination, expressing the concept's implications and its kinship with other concepts, then they are called aesthetic attributes of an object whose concept is a rational idea and hence cannot be exhibited adequately. The notion of aesthetic attributes has come in for a fair amount of discussion. And the interest in it is something like the following. When are concepts related to other concepts in ways that are aesthetic rather than inferential? I take it that's what...
Can you say that again? Slow.
When are concepts related to other concepts in ways that are other than inferential? Logical. And which is what the notion of aesthetic attribute does, right? It takes a concept and says it associates other concepts around it. Adorno would say it forms a constellation. When are those relationships such that we want to think of them as aesthetic in a way that corresponds to what I'm arguing is the notion of aesthetic idea? And nearly everyone agrees that the best example of a relationship of concept to concept that is not inferential is that of metaphor. That metaphoricity is exactly that setting up of a concept in relationship to another concept in which they inform one another in non-inferential ways and further in ways in which we cannot make the relationship fully determined. That indeed seems to be what metaphors are, the setting up of new ideas, new ways of thinking, by putting concepts to work in ways that their inferential powers do not themselves directly license. Now, having said that, the thought then strikes us immediately is something like, well, if aesthetic ideas are ones that break the boundaries of the understanding, if aesthetic ideas are ones that not only break the boundary of the understanding, but ones that even the imagination cannot fully totalize or make determinate, then isn't it as if aesthetic ideas do exactly the same activity of humbling that the sublime does? That it's as if the sublime was the notion of the sublime in its in successiveness, is really what we're using tacitly in thinking about aesthetic ideas. That thesis is precisely the thesis that is investigated by Kirk Pillow in his book Sublime Understanding. The book is divided up into three parts: an account of Kant's aesthetic reflection, which I'll say a bit about in a second. Then he turns to Hegel's aesthetics, and then tries to show that both metaphoricity in general and interpretation in general should be understood on the model of the sublime. It's an interesting argument. I want to look at just some features of his account of Kant in order to show what's at stake, because it will, I think, illuminate some of the path which we've already gone along, and also tell us why Kant, or say ways in which Kant goes wrong. So, Pillow's general thesis is that aesthetic judgment, in its activity of connecting and being relational, is clearly a different kind of activity than that of subsumption. So that reflection itself is a different way of engaging with ideas and concepts than that of making determinate or subsuming. And in particular, that what occurs in aesthetic reflective judgment is a judging not of inferential relations, but of relations of whole and part. That it's a part-whole logic that governs the entire analysis, but a part-whole logic in which the whole is necessarily indeterminate, purposive, but without a purpose. So both artworks and natural beauties are wholes, but they are not determinate wholes. That is, they're not for some identifiable purpose. And it's their lack of an identifiable purpose that sets in motion and keeps in motion, you might say, their parts. It's exactly because the purposiveness is without purpose that we are set on the activity of relating and connecting without end. Because to have an end would be to have a determinate purpose. So that structure of purposiveness without purpose is a way of thinking of the part-whole relationship that, if you want to be technical about it, is different than any conceivable mereological system. Mereology, for those of you who don't do deviant logics, is the logic of part and whole. And there are people who work on this, are there not?
Guy at NYU.
Guy Fine. My old teacher, Kit Fine, is actually a mereologist. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. There's a whole bunch of people at Brown who used to do mereology, Chisholm students. Anyway. Aesthetics is a different way of thinking about part-whole relationships. And it's the idea of an indeterminate unity that makes this possible. The requirement that there be an indeterminate unity means that the notion of form is always the notion of an open form. That artworks are always, at a certain moment, not closed in upon themselves. And this requires that there be two steps, according to Pillow, in the analysis of artworks along this line, namely what I suggested before, a beautiful form and a sublime content. So that when we're judging works of art, we are both trying to have a sense of them as wholes for which we appreciate that they are types of wholes that make a claim in virtue of that wholeness. And that's the moment of beauty. The moment of sublimity is because that wholeness is indeterminate and open, then the content, the movement of the content, is going to be sublime. And aesthetic ideas are therefore the paradigm for him of sublime content. Now, in thinking about this, and I think this is the only thing I want to say, let me just go through that one. The one bit of argument I think is important here is the following. Kant notoriously gives an account of the notion of symbolic expression, and above all, of course, significantly, the idea of the beautiful as a symbol of the morally good. So he gives his own account of symbol in those paragraphs where he's discussing the thesis of beauty as a symbol of the morally good. And when he thinks about the notion of symbol, he does so on the basis of analogy. And he claims that we can distinguish between quantitative analogies and qualitative analogies. Quantitative analogies, he says, can be determinate because they are like ratios. 2 is to 4, as 3 is to x. And the value of x there is going to be perfectly determinate, right? It's going to be
6.
Well done. You pass your logic exam at the NSSR.
that's as
sophisticated as we get. And in the case of qualitative analogy, he says that they do not provide determinate knowledge of the fourth term, but rather they offer only the relation to a fourth, but not this fourth member itself. And the argument or the example he famously gives is the one of the analogy of the handmill. The handmill is supposed to be in an analogy with despotic rule. And the thought is when you see a state apparatus mangling its subject's freedom, the way a handmill crushes through force, you know you're dealing with a tyrant. Well, using this example, He then, in paragraph 59, gives his famous account of that the intuition of beauty offers a symbolic expression of the directly unintuitable rational idea of the morally good. And the analogy is the following. In the appreciation of beauty, we experience, Kant thinks, a direct and disinterested liking that is reflective of a capacity for judging universally, free from the influence of merely sensuous charms. Moral reflection, analogously, involves the production of universal rules free from the influence of inclination. And so aesthetic experience offers an intuitive embodiment of the self-legislative vocation of practical reasoning. At 354, Kant sums this up by saying, through this analogy, taste enables us, as it were, to make the transition from the sensible charm to a habitual moral interest without making too violent a leap. So that the claim is something like, in aesthetic reflective judgment, we judge disinterestedly without being overwhelmed by sensation and charm. And this capacity is akin, indeed, analogous to the capacity to judge morally independently of our inclinations. That's the analogy. Of course, judging beauty, you might say, is see beautiful rose. Ah, it's beautiful. But when you're faced with, you know, a wild, rampant desire, and you're forced to judge universally, that seems hard. He says, but aesthetics eases us into that practice. It, as it were, eases us into the practice of disinterested judgment, of learning to detach ourselves from the claims of sensation and inclination. That's the core of that famous argument that beauty is a symbol of the morally good, and it strikes me as appalling. It strikes me as appalling above all because the analogy, in fact, reduces to a very not simple, but nonetheless direct simile. Namely, beauty can symbolize morality because aesthetic experience is like moral reflection due to the disinterested and free universality common to both. Well, I don't see anything about inexhaustibility or sublimity there. In fact, it strikes me as determinate as a quantitative analogy. And as a consequence, it seems to me to stand well short of the notion of inexhaustibility of meaning that Kant attributes to aesthetic ideas. The meaning of an aesthetic idea cannot be determined by any rule and certainly not by an analogical one. So aesthetic ideas cannot have symbolic function in Kant's sense. Hence, Kant's theory of symbols is totally insufficient for his notion of aesthetic ideas. Aesthetic ideas do not, Pillow says, I think plausibly, exhibit concepts or ideas at all. Instead, they express indeterminate and expansive ranges of meaning that no rule or concept or rational idea can encompass. It's that that leads Pillow to think that the notion of aesthetic idea is richer than Kant's notion of symbol, and that, like a metaphor, aesthetic ideas are unlimited and boundless in their content, which is to say that they defy determinate comprehension by any one concept. And in that sense, aesthetic ideas are sublime. Put it differently, aesthetic ideas surpass the maximum of comprehension that imagination faces in the experience of vastness. Second comment. Paragraph 51. The opening of it says the following. We may in general call beauty, whether natural or artistic, the expression of aesthetic ideas. The difference is that in the case of beautiful art, the aesthetic idea must be prompted by a concept of the object, whereas in the case of beautiful nature, mere reflection on a given intuition without a concept of what the object is meant to be, is sufficient for arousing and communicating the idea of which the object is regarded as the expression. On page back 301. I'm missing the passage I'm looking for. There it is. Sorry, okay. The paragraph right at the very beginning of 301. It will be said that this construal of aesthetic judgments in terms of a kinship with moral feeling looks rather too studied to be considered as the true interpretation of that cipher through which nature speaks to us figuratively in its beautiful forms. So nature is a cipher, that is a secret or untranslated language, and the beautiful is the expression of aesthetic ideas. Well, it's certainly an odd term to say that nature appears as art, although he is saying that, and that nature is an expression of aesthetic ideas, that you may say that's in opposition. What we've been doing, but is it? Well, I guess the question would be, what might the language of nature be? What ideas do natural objects express? What is Kant thinking about when he says natural beauty expresses? Think of it this way. We've all been going along with this game that we, you know, nature is beautiful. And we go ooh and ah about it. But it's utterly meaningless. Surely our concern for natural beauty cannot be meaningless. So what is it that we find in the beautiful that, like a work of art, might be thought of as expressing aesthetic ideas? Anyone want to risk the occasion? What?
Logical, but organization. The purpose.
Say more. It sounds a bit dry to move us.
It appears as if created, but could not have been created.
So one thing is it's very structure of awesome purposiveness, but without that thought that it could have been. I mean, you might say that, I always think of it this way, if intelligent design were true, we would not find the world beautiful. We'd find it a bit puzzling. What was he thinking? I don't get it. But not beauty. Beauty requires the without purpose. That would be one version of the thought. What else? I mean, I take it that he must think, and I think you just go just down the way Tom just went, that expresses ideas like nature, life, purpose, vitality, contingency, fragility. Look at a long-living tree. Sturdiness, whatever, you know, monumentality. I mean, they actually give us a sense of, let's call it, the contours of the natural world. It's not as if this is arbitrary, abstract aesthetic judgment, that they mean in their natural standing the things that go along with them standing like that. So if they are the sorts of things that stand just very fragilely and contingently, then they bear that idea. If they stand enduringly for a long time like a sturdy oak, right? Then we are struck. If they have, as we put our foot in the water, they surge with power,
and offer.
Then they express those ideas, that is, and these are not, I want to argue, mere projections, that because they are, why wouldn't they be mere projections?
Is that right? My question here. Yeah.
Well, can we be a little bit more anthropocentric and just say at some level it's what we want to feel at home in the world and find natural beauty makes us feel more at home than finding it ugly, because that's what we see ourselves as being from the earth as well, and that's where we end up.
Sure, I am certainly not. The question is, I'm not opposed to anthropocentrism. The question is, we don't want anthropocentrism to be a form of anthropomorphism. That's the question, that's the separation I'm trying to make. So I don't mind the anthropocentric gesture. How do we get that gesture so that it's not merely anthropomorphic?
Their idea is strictly related to their natural function.
Their ideas, of course, they are ideas that are related to them as bits of nature. That is, that's deeply important. That part of it will work just in case we are not treating them as ideas of gods or fairies or mere screens for ideas that are wholly extrinsic, but are standing as part of a natural habitat. That's certainly part of it. Yep. What else do we need to go that one further step? Yep.
We ourselves are natural beings.
Just that. That's all we need. All we need is that their appearance to us in that way is just our experience of them, as rather we experience in that way when we experience ourselves as natural beings in a natural setting. That is, to experiencing that way is exactly the removal of our anthropomorphic temptations and the attempt to relocate ourselves as members of a natural habitat. So that, of course, they are relational, but they're no more relational than the color red is relational. Of course, the notion of red requires eyes that see red, but it doesn't mean that there's no redness in the world. It means that it has its character only in relationship to sensibilities capable of detecting light waves of different lengths. Right? But it doesn't mean that there is no redness, or that redness can be reduced to light waves of different lengths, because what light waves of different lengths do is appear as different colors. That's what they do in relationship to natural objects like ourselves, fully natural objects. Hence, there is a, as you will, most of you will discover, there's a huge literature about the relationship between aesthetic ideas and relational ideas like color. And you can see why, from the case of natural beauty, that the problem seems exactly analogous. So I would want to say that the arguments we looked at the beginning of just in our attempt to say we found order, we found purpose, we, you know, struck by it, were all along subtly preparing us for this idea of aesthetic ideas, of nature as a language above and beyond the language of causality. Well, I guess the next step I need to make here, then, is to say something about the production of aesthetic ideas. So this is my working backwards now. And I'm finally getting to the beginning of this chapter, which is to say the production of artworks. And And here the argument takes a different turn. For the question of art is certainly in part a question or a general reflection on the question of the relationship of freedom or culture in relation to nature and body. And it's that relation that begins to come into focus in Kant's conception of genius. Genius is, or I want to suggest, both the exemplary expression of human freedom. So I want to say that thinking about artworks, thinking about genius, is actually a difficult and exemplary way of thinking about the nature of human freedom and the meaning of human freedom. And the reason for that is kind of obvious. Because when we make artworks, we make original, new sense, new meaning. So we make meaning that doesn't follow from existing rules. So art, notoriously, is about originality, about creativity. And therefore, originality and creativity, I want to suggest, are the concepts that help us best think about the meaning of freedom. That thinking about freedom as simply asking the question, is there some mechanism in the brain that is, let's call it the cosmological question of freedom and determinism, seems to me a hopeless way of thinking about the meaning of human freedom. And what we want to do when we think about the question of human freedom is we want to make the cosmological questions dissolve into irrelevancy. And I think thinking about the problems of creativity and originality are ways of dissolving the cosmological question of freedom. Because we're not going to ask ourselves the question. I think it's obvious why, right? If we can really talk about original sense, then the question, was it really caused, is a question about which I want to say we can only scratch our head. We have a perfectly... The structure of my argument, the structure of my claim here is like the structure of Strawson's claim in his great essay on freedom and resentment. How many of you read that essay? Yikes. You should all dig it out. This is absolutely known by every single analytic philosopher in the country. I've read it numerous times. Probably read it to death. It is a standard essay on the meaning of human freedom. And one of the things that Strawson is trying to do in that essay, following a kind of line of thought from Austin, is simply to say that if we woke up tomorrow morning, and there was a headline in the New York Times, MIT scientist discovers determinism is true, what would follow? And what Strawson wants to say is, he's pissed off. Right? His being pissed off is part of such a deep part of our grammar, because we distinguish between voluntary actions and involuntary actions, and we don't know what it would be like to draw that distinction. Right? Then the discovery that determinism is true cannot gain any traction in ordinary experience. So Strawson tries to show that we can't actually make sense of the claim given our structures of responsiveness to things that happen by accident or inadvertently or intentionally or, you know, we have a whole complicated language, right? So when we think that people's thinking is causally determined, we do things like lock them up, right? They cannot control their behavior. We send them to prison. We give them drugs. We, you know, we make distinctions, and nothing about the discovery that whatever it might mean. And what Strawson's saying is that the cosmological question of freedom doesn't mean anything. That's his intuition, that this whole paraphernalia of debate has nothing it can get attraction on in relationship to the practices of everyday life, where we have this whole complicated vocabulary. I've always found that, and I read the article because he does it so beautifully, so powerfully, so delicately, I should say it as well. It really is analytic philosophy at its best. Worth reading just for its sake. Well, I often think, now to follow the thought through, that the question whether an action was freedom in determined, free or determined, begins again to lose traction when we ask the question, was something done that was original? That the notion of creativity seems to me another version of the way of putting out of play the concern for the cosmological question. And that the question of genius shows that art is one of the, part of our fascination with art, part of our interest in art, is it is the consistent production of novelty. It is that area. We often think, and this is part of why I'm interested in the area of art, most of us are inclined to think that history is full of changes in which new things emerge. Whether you think it's progress or not is another question, but we do think it's new things emerge. But the problem of new things emerging in history is that history works very slowly. Often we can't see it happening. And therefore, the idea of and often it happens behind our backs, right? As Marx said, we make history, but not under conditions of our own choosing, so we don't have the sense of ourselves as makers. In the case of artifacts, like chairs and tables, we make things all right, but we make them in accordance with existing ideas. We simply follow a blueprint, follow a structure. The fascination of art is that in it we have an intimate experience of the production of new things, of new ideas, new objects, of people making sense in ways that follow no existing rules of sense-making. In that respect, art, therefore, it's not surprising.
Yeah? Doesn't that critique only really hold for mass production? What about when people would make a chair out of wood, and each chair was a singular chair?
But you could say that they were improvising in relationship to an existing idea,
sure,
on the basis of the wood they had and all,
sure,
that, right? So there you may so the skeptic, look, I mean, I'm not a skeptic, but the skeptic about such cases would want to say that's simply the place, way in which a certain practice is the way in which an idea meets reality.
Right.
But that's not to say that something new is produced. It just says that the way in which idea meets reality requires adjustments. But as a friend of mine always likes to give the example of,
is automatic landing systems. The pilot takes his hands, ties them behind his back. The wind is ripping and buffing. The plane, all by itself, does these minute adjustments. It registers the wind, all this, and it lands up. But it's a program. It's adjusting to contingency. It's making a new landing, like a new chair, but in a purely mechanical way.
Okay.
Now, that's the skeptical line, right? I am not suggesting that's the best way to think about craft activity. But I am suggesting that it's not surprising to me that we as modern subjects, part of our fascination with art, I'm suggesting now, is that it is an area in which freedom appears. And freedom appears in art as originality. And hence, let's call it the cult of originality, which is also the cult of the genius, right, is partially for us a fascination with the possibilities of transgression, of new meaning arising. And at least it gives us the sense that in this little enclosed sphere of art, which is not the wide, difficult world, we have some sense that, let's call it, history is possible. That history need not be a repetition compulsion. That history need not be simply the unfolding of mechanical laws. That history need not be the subsumption of human beings under social structures that determine the overall, that we are capable of shaping or fashioning the world. So Plato, think about the difference between Plato's love of craft. Plato, everything Plato is a goddamn craft. Right? Why? Because craft is you have an idea and you apply it. Right? That's why Plato didn't like art. Right? For the notion of craft for Plato meant the old. The old over every possible time. Plato wanted time to be dead. Right? And hence the notion of craft is, for Plato, dead time. We have an idea of history as a possibility of the new. The new, modern times and new times, right, are the same in German. Neuzeit. New time. Modernity is that experience of the possibility of new time. And art is, I would argue, the bearer of that idea of the possibility of new time, of fashioning and making, of self-changing.
Yeah. I was just going to say that there's an intermediate case between craft, if you interpret that as just repetition, and the aesthetic notion of genius, which is the democratization of genius, which America has undertaken self-avowedly, not to say that it might be an ideology, but and this is seen in pragmatism, for example, which has this moment of creativity, but always one that's democratized and incremental, and so on and so forth.
Well, there is
not much of a problem.
There are, in fact, different definitions of the very idea of democracy. One idea of democracy is simply the rule of self-rule. We rule ourselves. Or the rule of the majority, or some such thing. Another notion of democracy, for example, in Claude Lefort's writing, is collective self-making. That democracy is the way in which a collectivity determines who it is
by making itself over and over again. That is, by deciding who we are. So that democratic practice is the practice of asking the question, and I want to be clear, in my reading, it's asking the question, what is it to be a society at all? And how is it, in being a society at all, we relate to one another and to the world? That's a one-sentence version of the philosophy of Quintilius Castoriadis. That's his idea.
What would you say about what might be called like the latency period of new beautiful things, where a genius comes along with a new beautiful, but it takes a long time for the universal voice to take up this new beautiful thing?
What do you want me to say about
it? Well, it seems like there's something contingent about the beautiful that we take up, so that there is a number of different artists in the 20s who are doing different things. There might even be a certain theme that's being picked up a lot, but only certain ones get picked up to be beautiful and not after a certain lag period.
Yeah, except.
So then.
Well, this is great.
I'm not sure how it comes to be, if what you just said about that the experience of beautiful is experience of new, but we don't experience the two together immediately at the same time. We experience the new with something maybe ugly or banal.
Absolutely.
So then how do you explain that leg?
No, I mean, it's this is what the theory of genius is about. In order for something to be new, there must be a provocation. To say there must be a provocation, I mean it must in some way explicitly flout what we already believe about that domain. Right? Otherwise, it cannot strike us as new. So the new must appear, at least logically, I'm not talking about reality, but logically, the new always appears as a moment of nonsense. It must have that moment of excess in accordance with given regimes of sense in order for the possibility of being a systematic departure from it. So every new must necessarily risk two types of failure. It must risk the failure of, in fact, being destructive of existing rules, but in fact having no new rule to follow. That is, it may be just original nonsense, which is to say the possibility of failure is intrinsic to it absolutely. And occasionally we can come to recognize that there was exactly what you called latency. That there are ideas of the new, that given that fact, we have all the reason in the world to believe not only we're latent, but never got taken. So that there's no necessity here. And the primary object I'm going to talk about next week, if we ever get next week, is Demoiselle d'Avignon, which every single one of Picasso's friends thought was monstrous, except for Apollinaire. Apollinaire was the only one who said he thought it was wonderful, but he didn't know what it meant. But Apollinaire thought there was something great. Everyone else hated it. Hated it, and hated it so much that it stayed in his studio against the wall for a decade, got shown in 1918 finally, although there's an argument about whether it got shown or not, finally started to make its way in the world in 1924. So the latency period, given everything else that Picasso, huge reputation already, the world star, this thing could not be tolerated. Now, for us to recover that is difficult, since we live with our
So, and it's conceivable, right, that it never would have gotten into circulation.
Yeah. I wonder if another way of asking the question, though, is who actually produces the work of art that is the work of genius? Because if it's not just the artist who produces it in a way that shocks convention, but at some point some story then has to be told about what this new form is that at the time had no rules for its production, then somehow it's not just the artist through this great imaginary act that creates it, but the genius is also somehow the story that's told.
Absolutely.
And therefore it's the genius that doesn't just reside with the artist, but with its recognition.
In fact,
winning universal acceptance.
One of the things, absolutely. One of the things that Kant will want to say, and say alarmingly, is genius can only be recognized by genius. Which is to say, the only test of genius is someone responding to it in an appropriately genial way.
This is the connection of genius and education. This is Harvard's the most interesting point.
But it could be also interpreted in maybe somewhat more democratical. I mean, since some suggestions made about there's democratic forms of genius, that the genius is never totally superhuman otherwise.
It's not superhuman at all.
Not somehow. So
what it is, if I were Heideggerian, which I'm not, I would say it is a manifestation of human transcendence. That is the sense in which we are beyond ourselves, that we are not in complete self-possession of ourselves, including our own best thoughts, that we produce and speak and act in ways that are both intentional, but not in the intentional, fully purposive or fully under our control. And art makes explicit that notion of self-transcendence, which has about it, let's call it an anti-Cartesian conception of the subject, where the notion of subjectivity, where the Cartesian has something to do with something like absolute self-possession or absolute self-control, and whatever you don't control or can't purposely intend is mechanism, is nature acting against you. And Kant wants to use the notion of genius as to say that there is an excess in subjectivity beyond subjectivity, that is beyond intention control, that belongs to it in its, not in its failure of the human, but in its most expressive realization of itself in free creative action. That's what the notion of genius is trying to get at.
Okay, so I'm wondering about whether the way you're spinning out newness and novelty and originality can really fit within the framework of Kant's account of genius.
Let me put my cards on the table. My problem with Kant is it reads to me as utterly Maoist. It's a recipe for constant revolution. That's what makes it sound so crazy.
But
I don't want to insult any Maoists here. Crazy.
No, I mean they're examining themselves.
That's right. Actually, Maoists.
Well, because I say this, and this is I would take to be a standpoint from Castoriadis, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So if genius is nature giving rule to art,
right,
then there's a sense in which what is happening through nature is a kind of productivity,
right,
but not true creativity. So there's a difference between production, sort of bringing forth some form that was there in some way, and a radical break in which a new form that isn't reducible or can't be deduced from all previous forms comes about. So the role of nature, I'm wondering if it's playing more of a...
You're reading the role of nature in Kant as the bad unconscious? Is
Is that what you're up to?
I don't know what that means.
I mean, well, I take it what the question of the the question of nature here is the question of the imagination.
Right.
Right? And the question of the imagination is, I want to say, the indeterminate conditions for determinate action. So what Kant calls nature in giving the rule, rather than me giving the rule, is to acknowledge that there has to be this indeterminate plentitude of imaginary activity in order for true creativity to occur.
Okay. Well, isn't he talking about something more like deduction he talks about in the second half of the book? Right, I'm looking at paragraph 64, and he talks about deduction as the separation and recombination of raw material. Shows that these natural beings have separating the capability of very great originality. All our art finds itself infinitely outdistanced by nature in this deduction. But you could say that the way that human beings generate, say, the new is this deduction as well. So it's not a bad unconscious person.
I'm not sure.
Now you're between the horns of dilemmas you don't want to be in, aren't you?
Sure. No, I think the point about this sort of in nature as imagination, indeterminacy is maybe where some point I would concede to. But the
issue here is this, that freedom, instead of being willkür, which is just the power of spontaneity in Kant's moral theory, is the productive imagination here. And Kant does not have an account of the productive imagination other than his account of genius and aesthetic ideas. Right? So you may say there's a missing phenomenology of mental experience to back this up, but I take it that he's certainly, by nature, he doesn't mean anything more than the productive imagination. Right? Because he wants to use the notion of nature there because he wants two thoughts. He wants, not under my explicit control, but because he's Kant, he wants, somebody's got to be in control here. So he uses the word nature as a sign of anxiety about wanting both lawfulness but without intentionality. And so he has to have a notion of opaque lawfulness. That's the set of metaphors he's playing on. But I take it that all of that sets of anxieties boils down to the operation of the productive imagination. So, all right, let me give an explicit example. I can see you're all puzzled, and you're tired, and you're hot, and you want to go home. I'm going to make you suffer for 1 million. What strikes Kant is that the notion of inspiration cannot be legislated. So that I cannot explain to you how it is that I come to say these two concepts are going to make a metaphor. Right? So he is struck by that fact that the very nature of originality involves what I want to call a moment of transcendental opacity. Right? And must do. Right? If it wasn't a moment of transcendental opacity, then we're back in either pure intentionality or pure mechanicity. Right? So we have to have that sense, right? And Kant is then in anxiety about that moment, just the moment in which you say, oh God, I want to express how much I love thee. I love thee like a summer's day, right? And where did that come from? I don't know. You're not going to get there. You're not going to get there. You can't account for that, because to account for that exactly is the denial of originality. Right? So the difficulty of this moment is the difficulty of thinking about freedom without trying to, again, make it rule-bound. Right? And Kant, being Kant,
and he panics by saying, it's nature in us. But he just means the productive imagination. Okay, so what